It's the My Michelle Live podcast.
My Michelle Live, Sci Tech Talk, taking the God story to a geeky place. Here's Michelle.
I'm near Houston, Texas, enjoying some of the things that are happening around Texas. I'm getting some insight into what's happened since their big freeze, how it's affected their environment. I've been exploring games and all of the happenings here. There's just something inside us that wants to know a little bit more about the world around us, the planet we live on and the planets that surround us. There have been crazy great news stories concerning the red planet. What's happening? Three different missions have been launched to go to NASA, including NASA, to go to the red planet. One from China, one from the United Arab Emirates called the HOPE probe. NASA has the Perseverance rover. There's been a helicopter that the size of a tissue box that's been launched, and that's pretty exciting. There's just a lot happening. So we're going to talk about what is happening, what we're finding out, why we care, and we're going to do it with one of our longtime friends, Jeff Zwierink. He's an astrophysicist, research scholar at Reasons to Believe. He's actually the author of the book, Is There Life Out There? So really, who better to take this on today than our old pal, Jeff Zwierink. Hey, Jeff, welcome to Houston.
Really looking forward to our conversation today. This is just a fascinating, just from a technology standpoint, what we might find. There's just a whole lot of interesting things to talk about in this topic.
Well, I'm just up the road from NASA. I'll be visiting this week, maybe even later on today. And there's a lot of buzz going on about what's happening with actually three of these. All of these missions took advantage of a window of opportunity with the alignment of Mars and the Earth, which makes can save money, save time, and get you from, I think they launched in July, and now here we've got all this stuff happening starting in February. So with so much going on, I don't even know where to start, but it is pretty exciting. From three different locations, Jeff, on our planet, people, it just shows in human nature, we have this need to explore. So can you tell us a little bit about some of the missions and what they're hoping to achieve?
Well, I mean, Mars is the planet in our solar system. It is the planet that is most like Earth, and that it's the one that's closest to being able to support life. It's a pretty inhospitable environment right now. If for no other reason than if you go onto the surface of Mars at ground level, the atmosphere is about 50 times less dense than the top of Mount Everest. You take humans up to the top of Mount Everest, and we just start dying because there's not enough oxygen up there. So it's a pretty inhospitable place from a number of different angles. But it's the one, we know that there was liquid water there in the past. We found places where there's liquid water. And so each of these are going to be going out and exploring the planet, just because the more we know about it, the more that gives us insight into what's going on here on Earth, what does it take for life to work here on Earth, because we can explore whether there's any life on Mars, similar environments. So it just really gives us a bigger picture and helps us understand things and gives us, increases our sample size. We're looking at Earth. Earth obviously has life on it, but that's a sample size of one. So if we now go out and explore Mars and life, that will help us understand whether life is significant here in a way that we may not appreciate.
That's pretty amazing when you think of all of the implications. We have this natural curiosity. We want to know more. Oh boy, and as you're listening today, we're going to get to the implications of what that really means. What jazzes me, though, is one of the reasons why I'm geeky about science, Jeff, and that is because it shows us, it continues to reveal more of how we came to be. And the more we learn about how we came to be, the more it shows divine intervention. So we'll get to that as well. But I wanted to talk about this helicopter. It's the size of a tissue box, as I understand. I'm thinking here we are almost 120 years away from the Wright brothers first putting an airplane up in the air. And now we're flying little helicopters around Mars. What is this helicopter? Because this is pretty exciting. And what it can do is mind-blowing. How it operates will just make you go, what? Wow. And why is it any different? Is it really just a drone? Is there a difference? All of that, I'm giving it to you. Bring it.
Well, I mean, you know, so when we're exploring another planet, one of the things that we've been constrained to is just simply landing a object on the surface, and then what can it tell you about the surface around? So, for example, Phoenix was a lander that we put on Mars, within the last 15 years. I think it's been more recent than that. But all it could do is basically anchored itself in and had a scoop, so it could scoop stuff up, dump it into little chambers, do some analysis on it.
Okay.
At least in one of the scoops, it scooped up. It looked like there were these three rocks down in the corner. And it turned out those rocks were actually ice cubes. And so that gave us information about the planet. We've also put rovers, things that can drive around. There were Spirit and Opportunity. Those were designed to last for about 30 days. And 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years later, they're still exploring the Martian surface. We're exploring the Martian surface and telling us about what was going on. We even actually had a lander out there called Curiosity, which I think is amusing. And so now what we're doing, at least with Perseverance, one of the ways they're exploring the surface is that instead of just moving around and getting the pictures when it came in, they put a helicopter out there that could fly up and map out the terrain so that it knows where the rover could drive to. It can map out like that, but also just gives us a different view. And one of the things that's almost universally true in our exploration of the universe is that where we've developed a new tool to explore, we found new things that we didn't even know to expect to find. So when we developed an X-ray telescope, that opened up things in the cosmos we couldn't even explore before. And so being able to fly around on Mars will give us a lot more information and help us find things that we might have missed otherwise.
I know that one of the pictures that they showed was just extraordinary. A crater on Mars that shows signs of an ancient glacier. That may have melted from the top down. This goes beyond just collecting moon rocks and saying, look, this is cool. We're really learning a lot, and we're seeing more of maybe even the history, geology. The geology of the planet can show us what it's gone through. Has it always been warm? Has there potentially been life there? What kind of things are we looking at? What have we found that may show signs of life?
Well, even the place where Perseverance landed was a place called, I'm assuming it's Jezero, it's J-E-Zero, all one word, crater. And it's a crater that looks like it has a river delta flowing into it. So this crater was almost certainly filled with water sometime in the past. And it had some sort of river flowing into it. Now, again, presumably that's liquid water because that's the temperatures where that would work out. And water is a very abundant molecule in the universe. So certainly Mars, Venus, and Earth all started with an abundance of water on it. And so the idea that Mars had water is really a well-substantiated idea. You know, I was referring back to that Phoenix lander, and the Spirit and Opportunity rovers. As you kind of scrape into the surface of Mars, you find this white silica. You know, it's just 90% plus pure silica. And the way you get 90% plus pure silica usually is to have a large body of water where silicates are flowing in and the silica precipitates out. So there's certainly signs that there was a lot of water on Mars in the past. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been gone for a long time, or liquid water. And so the question is, okay, in these regions, areas where we know there was liquid water, let's go explore there and see if we can find any signs that maybe there was life there in the past. Now, that's a challenging task, because preserving life for long periods of time after died out, even on a planet like Mars, which is not particularly geologically active, it's a pretty difficult thing, but it's a really fascinating thing to study.
Well, so what would they be looking for? What kind of things can they find that would show signs of life? Fossils, for example, or?
Well, the biggest thing they're hoping for is there are fossil remains. Now, they're not going to find a dinosaur bone or a chicken feather or anything like that.
Hey, but if they do, never say never. That might be really cool. That's going to be terrible.
I don't expect it. Nobody expects to find anything like that. But what they are looking for are there are single-celled or very simple organisms, you know, that left fossil remains here because of their conglomeration or the communal behavior. For example, there are these stromatolites, which are organisms that grow together in mats and clumps, and then those get compacted and fossilized. So they're looking for signs like that. Maybe there's a certain chemical signature, because as life operates, it tends to differentiate the different isotopes of carbon. So they're looking for signs like that. Based on what we know of how life works here on Earth, might we find similar signatures in this environment on Mars, where we would expect if the same sort of processes that brought about life here on Earth are in operation on Mars, let's go look for the signs of those kinds of life. So that's what they're trying to do, you know, finding stromatolites, chemical signatures, those sorts of things that would give us hints that maybe there was life here.
So if we are looking for signs of kind of a primitive kind of life, I mean, would that really be surprising? I mean, is the universe itself, does it have is it alive to a degree? Is there signs of life everywhere, but maybe thus far we haven't seen the abundance and the uniqueness that we have on planet Earth? Are we looking for signs of little green men? I'm just going to get it out there, because
I would say no, we're not looking for signs of little green men. But what we are looking for, and when we look at life here on Earth, life is incredibly resilient, incredibly abundant. Everywhere where we have gone on Earth and thought there might be life, we found life there. And in fact, we've even found life in places we didn't think life could exist. And so life is very abundant and prolific here on Earth. And so the thought is maybe the same was true on Mars. Now, when we're dealing with that, there is one caveat in that, is that once life is there, life is incredibly resilient. But it may not be that easy to get started. You know, what we do see here on Earth is that life was around from the earliest times we thought it was possible. But life is a pretty complicated thing. I would say it's very well designed. Mm-hmm. Look at the genetic code of life here on Earth. It's not just some genetic code that was thrown together. It is an incredibly resilient, well-designed code, and it is the genetic code that all life on Earth shares. And it's not just what are the gene sequences, it's the way it's put together so that it works for life to exist. And so I find evidence that life is incredibly resilient, that it's adaptable, but I also find evidence that it's very well-designed. And so I would argue that's a creator who's fashioned life and put it here on Earth. And so that's really, in my opinion, the question we're asking on Mars is, did that creator also put life out there on Mars? And I think that's a fascinating question, logically and scientifically.
Exactly, because it begs the question, is there those signs of life? And we hear those news stories all the time. Life was found, you know, and then you're like, okay, well, really, it looks like water. And, you know, so you're not looking at little green men anywhere. We haven't found them. And we'll get to if that's an issue or not, you know, if we ever will. And you delve a bit into that in some of your writings. But, Jeff, would it surprise you, though, if there are bits of primitive life here and there throughout the universe? I mean, if we're looking at a sort of a Big Bang, we all came from something. This all came from something. Wouldn't there be signs of that, whatever life helped bring the universe into being throughout, interwoven throughout the universe here and there?
So as a Christian, I look at that, you know, kind of, as a Christian who's also a scientist, I look at it theologically and scientifically. And, you know, from a theological perspective, Christians have discussed whether life is only here on Earth or whether life is scattered throughout the universe for as long
or,
as...
or in multi-universes, you wrote a book on that.
That's a fair point, too. And, you know, if it's scattered throughout the universe, it may be scattered throughout the multiverse as well. But, you know, there's kind of this prevailing notion that if we find life out on Mars, well, oh, that means naturalism is true. Christians and all the other religions should just kind of pack it up and they're just wrong. And it just really is not reflective of the way Christians, at least, have thought throughout history. For example, Galileo, a very prominent scientist, advanced our understanding of the cosmos tremendously. Very devout Christian, thought that only Earth had hosted life, that's what God had done. Kepler, a contemporary of Galileo, again, greatly advanced our understanding of the cosmos, thought life was scattered throughout the cosmos. Also a devout Christian. So 400 years ago, before science really even had a way of weighing in on this topic, you've got Christians saying, no, God only created life here. No, God created life in other places. So this has been a theological discussion that's gone on for millennia that science is just now beginning to weigh in on. And so I think I'm just excited about what we're going to find as we go out and explore Mars. I'm sure people will use whatever we find to advance their naturalist or supernatural worldview. But I'm excited about finding out what's going on because that tells us more about what God did.
There's a thought that it does indeed, but whether there's bits and pieces of life throughout the universe, as you had mentioned, water, which I'd like to just do a show on the miraculous, incredible nature of water, is scattered throughout the universe, which is crazy interesting. But yet there's a thought that says that it takes an entire universe to support what we have here on this planet, of not just let's look on this rock of a red planet and see if we can find anything that looks like life, to teeming with abundance and a gorgeous life, diversity. I mean, here I am, I live in Seattle, I am in Houston and Galveston, and the fauna and flora are abundant, but quite different. Teeming with life, you know, does it indeed, and what is the thought behind it takes an entire universe to support what we have here?
Well, I mean, you kind of alluded to it earlier, is that you know, there's a lot of stuff that has to happen in the universe for life to be here. You know, when we talk about water and we think, okay, water is a molecule, it's actually the third most abundant molecule in the universe. Hydrogen exists in a form where two hydrogen atoms bond together. That's its most common form. That's the most abundant molecule. There's a three-proton version of hydrogen, and then water is the next most abundant molecule. But you know, all of the stuff that our physical bodies and our Earth are made of, all of that was ultimately processed through stars at some point in time. So all the carbon we have comes from stars. All the oxygen we have comes from stars. All the nitrogen we have comes from stars, because in the earliest moments of the universe, after about 4 minutes, all you had were hydrogen, helium, and a little bit of lithium and beryllium and deuterium. So that's all you had, and then everything else was made from stars. So the universe seems like it's designed to produce the things that life requires, the carbon, the nitrogen, the oxygen. So once you have the universe is producing it, but you also need a place where it can all be put together, where liquid water can exist, and carbon is reactive. It turns out that carbon is reactive right in the range where water is liquid. And so those two working together, I agree, those are very remarkable, almost miraculous elements and compounds. So it really does take a universe of the kind that we have to even enable life in the first place. But once you have that universe, now you need to look and say, okay, does this planet have what it takes for life to exist? Does this planet have what it takes? We know Earth does. Mars has at least some of those signs where there's liquid water in the past, and if liquid water, most everybody, or there seems to be this prevailing assumption that where you have liquid water, life's going to be right there with it. So let's go out and explore Mars and see whether that's the case. I think it might be. We're going to find that there's no life on Mars, and that would show that the conditions for life are really more exacting than we thought. Or it may well be that we find that God has created life on Mars as well.
So it's like to me, some of the areas that you mentioned here on Earth where you would think no life exists, right? And we go and we explore, And sure enough, there's some kind of rudimentary life, but it's, again, not like the life that we see as I drive around Texas. You know, we see the longhorns and the these beautiful oak trees and tumbleweeds. You know, we see this kind of life and intelligent life. But if we're looking at some of the most extreme places on Earth, we have found rudimentary life, but there is quite a difference.
No, there really is. You know, we tend to think of life as people and things that can think about it, or even animals, or all the stuff we can see. The vast majority of life is single cellular, and even here on Earth, stuff that we can't see without a microscope. And you know, that's the sort of stuff we would expect to find, at least from a naturalistic viewpoint, because it's just simpler to make. You know, and one thing to always keep in mind in all of this is that, you know, obviously life is incredibly abundant here on Earth, but we know that there are mechanisms that transport life from, or transport stuff from one planet to another. There are asteroids that hit on Earth, they excavate life, throw it out into space, and then those things will land on other planets. In fact, back in, I think it was 1994, there was a big to-do because one of the asteroids from Mars had actually made it to the surface of the Earth, and we thought there might be life in it. So we know there are mechanisms that transfer life around. It may very well be that Earth is the only place where life got started, but there have been things that have seeded other planets in our solar system. And life is pretty resilient. It wouldn't surprise me to find that Earth life was transported to Mars and then found a way to get a foothold and survive there. So yeah. That would be a fascinating.
It would be, and to a degree. But yet, throughout all of the known universe, we're not seeing the kind of life, and specifically this intelligent life. For example, if we see some kind of fossil of some kind of thing that survived in Mars, likely those little things weren't thinking, wow, what is that glowy planet out there, third from the sun? I think I'd like to go explore that, right? We're really, as far as we know, there's a uniqueness to that. And you think of all the preparation that we're doing right now to go to send people to Mars. There on my island, the big island of Hawaii, Mauna Loa, there's research being done where people are living in these extreme circumstances, isolated as they would be on Mars, to go and live there. It's kind of a training. They need specific people who get along with others, don't get bored easily because they have what's called food fatigue. And you know, we've all had that. Mom, are we having spaghetti again? You know, we've all been there. And there's this training. And just this last week, Jeff, I went to a place here in Texas. It's called the George Ranch. And they have these astounding buildings throughout the last few hundred years of people and how they lived here in Texas back in the day when they gave land away, but people had to come to this land with only what they could fit in a wagon and just figure out how to survive, right? Just make it. It's kind of in our nature to be able to do this. This isn't the first time. It may just be the first time we've done it on a planet that doesn't have air, that doesn't have life. And did you hear about the schooner? There's a guy who is going to help train astronauts. He built a schooner was at sea for 3 years, never restocked. It's just astounding. People who want to explore. Now we want to explore the red planet. And I'm asking you your thoughts on how we are so different. We don't know of any other life here on planet Earth. I mean, my dog's not going, hey, what's up there? Let's go, right? It's pretty astounding.
You know, it really is. And that is one thing that everybody agrees distinguishes us from the animals. Everybody recognizes that humans really do think and behave differently. We make conscious choices. We are aware of our place in things. We think about what could be different as opposed to what is. We anticipate, we reflect. There is just this consciousness, and it really does flow out in a desire to go out and explore. I mean, my wife and I just recently watched a documentary about people who want to go to the top of Mount Everest, and you know, there's a part of us that's go, why would people want to go up where they've got a good chance of dying? But there's something about humanity that wants to go out and explore, and that separates us from every other creature here on Earth. And you know, I kind of relate to that. The idea of being the first person to set foot on Mars, that would be too cool for words in a lot of ways. You know, it's tempered by the fact that I probably won't ever come back, and I'll likely die there, and I've got responsibilities and obligations here.
And you may never have a cheeseburger again. You'll never get, I'm here in Texas, you'll never get a Whataburger. That's it, done. I mean, unless Uber designed something really cool that could get you there anyway.
That's a fair point. And, you know, so there are things that are very different. But, you know, we, as humans, we seem inclined to want to do that. We've explored every possible region on Earth. We've tried to get to the deepest depths, the highest heights, the most remote, the coldest, the hottest, whatever. How can we do it, and can we survive and thrive there? So the idea of going out and exploring our solar system seems to be the next natural step. It does show, you know, quite honestly, as we go out and try and get to Mars, you know, we sent rovers, we sent satellites. As humans, we're designed to live well here on Earth, and we can adapt to the extreme environments. But boy, you get out into space, and there are some really difficult things. Bone density degrades. Cranial, or you know, things happen to our brain. The cosmic radiation causes damage. There's all sorts of things that I do wonder if, at the end of the day, the inhospitable or the hostileness of the universe may kind of confine us to living here on Earth, or maybe in the near regions where we could go out and engineer things well. But yeah, like I said, I've learned not to bet against humanity and our ingenuity, because things that often seem impossible, God's given us the capacity to figure out. So I don't know whether we're going to go out and explore, but it does certainly seem like we're driven to do it.
But it does speak to the anthropic principle. I wanted to talk about that. What is it, and how does it relate to not only our desire to visit the red planet, but what it speaks to about us and how we were created?
Well, I mean, as scientifically, when we talk about the anthropic principle, it's kind of this recognition that when we look at the universe, it seems like it's designed and set up for life to be here. You know, we talked about, you know, carbon is an ideal element, the ideal element for building biochemistry. There really is no other element that can handle the complexity that biochemistry requires. You ask, where is all the carbon formed? It's actually in the hearts of stars. And when you ask, how does it form? It's this intricate interplay of the laws of physics that even permit it to be formed so that life could be here, because you got to have the carbon, you got to have the oxygen. So it seems like somebody monkeyed with the physics of the universe so that carbon exists, so that life can exist. And so that's kind of the idea behind the anthropic principle, is that it looks like things are fine-tuned or designed for us to be here. And, you know, people will offer all sorts of explanations for why that is, that maybe the universe is alive, maybe there's a God, maybe there's a multiverse. You know, I mean, they'll throw all sorts of explanations out to try and explain that. But when we look at the universe, it seems like it's suited or designed for us to be here. And again, that makes perfect sense, that there's a creator who fashioned us for a purpose.
And when you say it seems like, and there's fine tuning, we're not just talking about, oh, it kind of seems like there might be. I mean, we are talking about extraordinary fine tuning of this universe, extraordinary happenstances, not just one or two, but there are what, five principles, five things that are absolutely needed for life that have to happen, and have to happen in the right way, the right combination, the right timing to make life, just life happen. Mars, little things that we might be able to find that could show us that some kind of rudimentary life existed. I'm not just even talking about that. I mean, the life that we have here, the fine tuning is mind boggling.
You know, it really is. We find fine tuning when we look at just the various concepts of physics. You know, there are kind of 26 parameters in our standard model that can be twiddled and tweaked. And most of those, if you change them just a little bit, they throw off what's necessary for life to exist. So you see it in the very in the constants of the laws of physics. You see it in the fabric of space-time. We think, okay, yeah, you could have more dimensions, less dimensions. But given the laws of physics, the fabric of space-time needs to be a certain way. You see it in the age of the universe, that there's a certain time span where life seems to work well. You see it in the size of the Earth, the type of the sun. What I find fascinating is not that there's a single, or even I can give you 5 or 10 quantities. It really does seem like the more we understand about the universe, the more that notion of fine-tuning and design grows. And so there are times where it's like, okay, we thought that the mass density was fine-tuned, but an inflation actually produces that. Well, the mass density still needs to be fine-tuned. We just found the mechanism. But now as we look at how inflation, there's actually fine-tuning built into inflation to get something that looks like our universe. So it seems like this notion of fine-tuning or design is very pervasive, that we may squeeze on it, get rid of it, but it seems to just keep popping up. The more we learn about the universe, the more it seems to be there. And that to me says it's not just, oh, this is interesting. It's like, oh, this is fundamental to the universe.
Yeah, and it continues to point to not only intelligent design, but as we look at that design, it gives us insight into the designer, which tends to, as we progress, learn, discover, investigate, point to the God of the Bible. And I guess I wonder if that's why the information in our textbooks in schools are oftentimes pretty old and not quite updated. I mean, if we were to really reveal, like we do here, like you do with Reasons to Believe, and like we do here on My Michelle Live, I think it puts people in a position where they have to say, oh, wow, what are the spiritual, if you would say, implications?
You know, that's a very good point. There's a point to where there's only so much you can teach in school, but I think that as we learn and grow and we talk and the more you learn, at least as an adult, as you educate, you become more aware of how the world works and what we know, but really you do have to deal with this idea that it looks like, as we survey the universe, it looks like there's a purpose behind it. Now, it may be that there is, you know, the naturalist might be right and there's no purpose, but you still have to now wrestle with, it looks like there's a purpose. And scientists, as they're exploring things, you know, they keep talking about, well, we have to remember this isn't really designed, but it looks designed. And so that notion is pretty prevalent. And I do think it has deep spiritual implications, because I think there is a God who designed everything, who set everything in motion, who created everything, who designed things for us to know him. And if that's true, it brings a great confidence to me as a Christian, because if God is who he says he is, as we explore the universe, there's nothing we're ever going to find that actually shows that he's not who he says he is. And so I can just be excited about what we're going to find and go out and explore, and it'll cause me to grow. I'll be able to learn more, and I'll be learning more of what he's revealed for us to know. And as a Christian, I find that just incredibly fascinating. And as a scientist, that's why I became a scientist, is because I love figuring out why things work the way they
do. Yeah, for me, it's understanding a little bit more about the designer. This is my cell phone. So if you were to just take this cell phone and say, you know, this kind of looks like it was designed, doesn't it? And as you look at maybe the design of it and what's on it, it could tell you a little bit about its purpose, why it's here, what it's designed for. I mean, obviously, this thing's designed because the designer was trying to get people to communicate, to connect, right? It gives you some insight into who that person might be and what is important to them. I think the same thing goes for the universe. You know, it's this magnificent machine like the cell phone. Can we know why it exists? If there's reason within it, and I say yes, can we know a little bit about the designer? There's reason to believe that looking at the universe does point us to the God of the Bible, and we can see it in every story, including these Mars stories of today. I'd like your thoughts on that.
No, I wholeheartedly echo what you're saying. Is, you know, that as we look, we see that the universe is particularly fit for life, that the Creator wanted life to be there. We see that there's this incredible, idyllic environment for us to live in, that the Creator cares about us and wants to provide for us, has given us ability to understand, which I would argue means that the Creator wants to interact and relate to us, that's our ability to understand it is flows into being able to relate to the Creator, and also just the majesty of what we see, that the Creator wants us to worship Him, that we're designed to worship Him. So I do think as we look at how this creation is put together, we do get insight into who the Creator is and what He's designed. But I do think we always have to bear in mind, if you hand that cell phone to a five-year-old, they're likely to use it improperly, and they're going to say, well, why is this, and why did it break? And their lack of knowledge doesn't mean that it wasn't designed well. If we're not the Creator,
come on.
That we see may not, well, why did, that doesn't seem, more often than not, what we found is as we've investigated, there was a level of design we weren't even aware of. And so that to me, I just, again, if God is who He says He is, we're never going to exhaust what we understand or learn about Him as we study creation. And so where we find things that look like they're bad design, to me, that's a sign that, okay, there's something deeper we need to get at. And every time we've done that, we've found, there's an intricacy of the design we didn't even understand. And so I wholeheartedly agree that the creation and the design in there reveals the Creator, because the Creator wants us to know Him. That's really what the message of the Bible is about.
That's a great point. You bring it home. And your books, things like, is there life out there? Who's Afraid of the Multiverse? Both, I think, have a point that is pertinent to what we're talking about today. And that is, as we learn, discover, grow, we also see throughout history that there were times where people say, aha, see this discovery, that kind of shows God doesn't exist. And, you know, really, who's afraid of discovery? Who's afraid of science, poking, prodding, testing? Why? Because in the end, we do look and say, wow, well, maybe this is something we haven't seen before, and we have yet to make a real discovery in science that disproves or brings huge despairing issues that are brought up in the Bible and goes, oh, wow, well, boom, there you go. Case closed, close it up, let's move on. Am I correct?
That is very well stated. And, I spent the past 20 years of my life doing science apologetics, looking how science and the Christian faith work together. And, you know, as I first started doing Gages, actually probably closer to 30 now, and as I first started doing Gages, I found, oh, yeah, there's evidence for design in the beginning, and, you know, I've been a Christian for a long time. I mean, I was convinced Christianity was true. But what I found, even as I began studying, and if you asked me directly, I said, of course science and Christianity go together. What I actually thought was, as new discoveries came out, I found that I was thinking, and I found it through anxiety and tension that was arising. I found myself thinking, maybe this is the discovery that's going to show Christianity wrong. And kind of my challenge, if I could, to you and your audience, is to think about that. Do you really believe that God is the Creator and that He's revealed Himself in creation? Because as I thought about what I was thinking wrongly, it gave me a chance to think rightly. And I can say that once I had the opportunity, as I thought and meditated, prayed through that, I realized, you know, if God is who He says He is, we're never going to have that discovery that shows He doesn't exist. And it freed me up to just be excited about whatever we found. Now, there's been plenty of stuff that I still don't understand, but I'm no longer worried that we're going to have a discovery that God doesn't exist. Because every place where I thought that might happen, as I investigated it that deeper, it's like, no, this actually shows that God is who He says He is.
So I agree.
I'm far more convinced of the truth of Christianity because I dealt with my fear that maybe Christianity wasn't true.
And I'll take kind of a counterpoint on that. I'm not afraid of digging in and saying, okay, if it's not true, I need to know this. I want to know this. I don't want to just build my faith on something just because it feels good or seems right. I'm okay with discovering that, okay, fine, let's find out the truth. And as I go along that road, I'm with you continually. I'm floored. I am brought to my knees at God's creation, at what I find in science. I'm brought to my knees by God's goodness and his faithfulness. It's so exciting. When we look in nature, we look in science, we look in the stars, or even the many people, and we've talked about this on the show, Jeff, the many people who have set out to disprove claims of like the resurrection and the like, and have come with this astounding walking away going, oh, there's more evidence, historical evidence for the resurrection than anything else that we put into our history books. It's amazing. And so you're left, whether it's delving into the resurrection or it's delving into what's happening on Mars, you're left going, there is evidence. And this puts me in a place where I have to make a decision. Am I going to believe what the evidence says, or am I going to, well, continue to try to disprove it? I'll give you the final word.
I wholeheartedly agree with what you're saying. And, I just kind of, what if as Christians we were leading the charge in not only declaring the truth, but knowing and understanding it and pursuing, what does creation have to say? What does science have to say? What does the Bible have to say? What do all these different areas have to say if we're leading the charge of being passionate about understanding the truth? Because, Jesus claims to be the truth. So let's be passionate about knowing the truth. Because as Jesus said, the truth will set you free. So I wholeheartedly concur with what you said.
I'm with it. This is pretty exciting since we've been broadcasting together for years now. And, now we're doing FaceTiming here with Zoom. It's so exciting to be able to be sitting here having my cup of tea with you. So it's really good to connect with you, Jeff. And you know that I have a very special place in my heart for you and all the scholars there at Reasons to Believe, where you can go to reasons.org if you're watching or listening right now. So give a big hi to everyone there for me.
Michelle, really enjoyed our conversation. Thanks for having me on again.
Thank you. Music is around.
More SciTech Talk at mymichellelive.com.